summer is in the home stretch this year in the good old USA. But even with cooler days ahead, climate change remains on the front burner. This week, we are fortunate to have somebody who many consider the father of climate change science in the United States. He's here in the Twin Cities, and he's Dr. James Hansen with NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. We interviewed him on All Things Considered this week. Here's Minnesota Public Radio's Tom Cran.
So give us an example or two of the very latest new science or new evidence out there for climate change and global warming.
Well, I think it's the empirical evidence for what's happening. And Will Steger's observations in the Arctic are a good example. What has happened in the Arctic sea ice? Last summer, in 2007, there was only about half as much sea ice at the end of the summer as there had been 30 years ago. And it's been going up and down from year to year, but generally there's a downward trend, and last year is particularly strong. And this year, it looks like it's going to be very similar to last year. So it's just what we expected with global warming. We get this positive feedback effect. As the ice melts, then it reveals a darker surface. That makes it warmer. You get more melting. The danger is that that will also begin to happen on the ice sheets, and that's going to really be a problem if it does.
So in other words, as the ice melts and the ice caps we're talking about here, the effect then is speeded up?
Yes, that causes additional warming because it makes the surface of the planet darker.
What environmental clues do you see being observed that will make it known that we've literally reached a tipping point where there's no turning back?
Well, the example that I just gave you is a tipping point.
Really?
But the one that we're especially concerned about are those that would be irreversible. The Arctic sea ice could grow back if the planet gets a little bit colder. But if the ice sheets disintegrate, that is irreversible on time scale of thousands of years, because an ice sheet takes many thousands of years to grow up from snowfall piling up year by year. So we don't want those ice sheets to begin to disintegrate. And the other irreversible thing would be loss of species. If we cause the climate zones to move so rapidly that we drive species to extinction, well, they're gone forever, and new species can come into being. It's happened before. The Earth has had large climate changes of several degrees, and more than half the species on the planet went extinct. Well, new ones came into being, but it took hundreds of thousands of years. So for any time scale that humans can think about, we would be leaving a much more desolate planet for our children and grandchildren, so we don't want to pass that tipping point.
How close are we to either of those that you just mentioned, tipping points, irreversible tipping points?
Well, I think we're getting very close. I think that we've already reached a level of gases, which if we left it there indefinitely, it would cause us to pass those. So
when you say very close, you mean in decades, years?
I mean within decades, yes. I think, and in order to avoid those changes from happening over the next several decades, we're going to have to begin to reduce our emissions within this decade, within the next 5 to 10 years.
You have said that this election, this 2008 presidential election, is critical for the planet. You made those remarks before Congress earlier this summer. Why?
Because if we don't get on a different path with our emissions within the next several years, we are going to pass tipping points. And this next year is critical because we will get a new president in the United States. It's the opportunity to reassess what we're doing there. And the Kyoto Protocol is reaching a point where they've got to decide on what's going to follow after it. So this next year or two is critical to determining the future of the planet.
If I'm correct, you said back in 2004 that you yourself would have voted for John McCain if he was a choice on the ballot. He wasn't, but he is this year. Would you vote for him this year?
Well, you know, the thing that attracted me to John McCain several years ago was his position on campaign finance reform. I think that the biggest problem we have is money in government and the undue influence that it has on the decisions that are made in Washington. Now, he has not followed through on that. I'm disappointed in the fact that we did not succeed in getting effective campaign finance reform.
Is that related to climate change, would you say?
Well, yes. You know, it is related. Yeah. It's very much related to climate change. Coal and oil, we have a lot of Congress people who are well-oiled and coal-fired. And unfortunately, that is the biggest obstacle to getting the changes that we need in order to solve the climate problem. You know, we could. There are many benefits of a cleaner atmosphere. We've got to move beyond fossil fuels at some point, so why not do it sooner? Well, the reason we're not doing it is because of the influence of those special interests.
So 4 years have passed, and you've become disenchanted with John McCain when it comes to finance reform. But
Yeah, well, both candidates are obviously going to be, either of them would be a big improvement as far as their recognition of the reality of global climate change and the fact that we're going to need to adjust our energy policies.
Who's got the more attractive plan for you in that
regard? I'm not sure that either of them has articulated an adequate plan. We're going to have to phase out coal use unless we capture the CO2. We could do that, but, you know, the clean coal that they talked about, the future gen, a better name for that would have been never gen, because they didn't intend to ever complete the project, because it's going to be more expensive if you capture the CO2. And so their utilities would prefer to burn dirty coal. Unfortunately, it not only makes the atmosphere dirty and emits mercury and it also has environmental problems when you remove the mountaintops and pollute the streams. But the primary problem is it releases CO2, and that's the main cause of global climate change. So we've got to do something about that.
Are you confident there would be progress in either a McCain administration or an Obama administration?
You know, they've both made statements that concern me. At one point, Obama was talking about making oil out of coal. Well, that's, unfortunately, we can't do that if we want to preserve our planet. They don't yet seem to understand that. Well, they've begun to change their statements a little bit in that regard, but still I haven't seen an adequate. So I have not made up my mind.
You're in the undecided?
I'm in the undecided at this point.
In April, you addressed a plea to Governor Pawlenty. You wrote a letter and then followed it up with a fairly detailed document with some recommendations to provide. You wanted the governor to provide more leadership when it comes to the issue of climate change. What did you hear back?
I unfortunately did not get a positive response back. I did not get a formal response, but I did get his administration did respond to the media. And they did not accept my conclusion that they should oppose new coal-fired power plants. You know, the governor gets credit for making some statements about the need to deal with the climate change and make goals for reducing emissions in the future by certain percentages. But the truth is that we cannot solve the problem if we're building more coal-fired power plants. And that he should make a strong statement to that effect. And I understand politically why he's not. Apparently, it's because neighboring governors in South Dakota and other states want to sell more coal. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to figure out a different way to make our money, because coal is just not going to allow us to keep a reasonable climate and preserve creation.
When we think of this issue, we tend to think of tailpipe emissions, automotive emissions. But you keep bringing up coal here, which is worse.
Yeah, you see, that's what was not recognized by the public and even scientists for a while, and that is the fact that the emissions of carbon dioxide have a very long lifetime. After 1,000 years, about 20% of it is still in the atmosphere. So if you slow down your tailpipe emissions a bit, that doesn't really help very much. It is important, because we're going to have to figure out a way to power our vehicles that does not emit CO2, and we're not there yet. So we had better buy ourselves some time by having more efficient vehicles. And the thing that we do come up with eventually, electric cars or hydrogen-powered cars or boron-powered cars, those are, it's always going to be, efficiency is always going to be important. So we should be demanding greater efficiency for our vehicles. But most of the CO2 in fossil fuels is in coal. And oil is already beginning to run out. So it is not the big issue. The big issue is coal. That's what we could phase out. We could decide we're only going to use coal at power plants where we capture the CO2 and sequester it. If we would make that decision, and if over the next 20 years we would phase out the existing coal-fired power plants, then we could keep the peak CO2 at about 400 to 425 parts per million. And then by means of improved agricultural and forestry practices, we could draw down the amount of CO2 to less than 350 parts per million, and we could solve the problem. But we're not doing that.
When it comes to the well-oiled and coal-fired politicians, as you put it, is that on both sides of the aisle as you see it?
Yes, it is.
You have been outspoken on this issue, you have been so this afternoon and in other, whether it's before Congress or in other interviews. What has the official reaction been like at NASA, your bosses?
You know, since I complained about the censorship of NASA public affairs, and it was became very,
back,
there
yeah.
was enough documentation to prove that was the case. The NASA administrator did make a strong statement that scientists should be allowed to speak out, and there has not been any objection to my continuing to do that.
The president in the last State of the Union gave a tip of the hat. Some would say not nearly enough and a bit too late, but a tip of the hat toward global warming. With that, are you seeing things change politically to where they need to be for some of the changes you want?
No. You know, the problem is they've admitted there's that global warming is real and that humans are causing it, but they're still basically a fossil fuel-driven administration. And, you know, Congress is strongly under the influence of the fossil fuel industry, so it's not going to be easy. The people are going to have some effect on the politicians, and we'd better change some of them with this next election if we hope the next Congress will take strong enough action.
ExxonMobil posted record profits for any corporation in history in the last couple of quarters, right? How is that stranglehold on our government going to break if they have that money and are willing to do it?
Yeah, unfortunately, they even are beginning to try to greenwash themselves. You look at the advertisements they write, and they talk like they do understand there's a climate problem. But look at their investments. They are not investing a substantial amount of money in clean energy, in renewable energies. They're still banking on just selling more fossil fuels. And we've got to get, because the captains of industry are the potential solutions. If they would begin to invest their money and their time in the clean energies, we could solve the problem. But until they're convinced that they're not going to continue to be allowed to make their big profits selling fossil fuels, they're not going to make that change.
Is there profit in renewable and cleaner sources of energy?
It would be if we would put a proper carbon price on a proper price on carbon emissions. Then the renewables would begin to compete. And I think we should also look with an open mind at the next generation nuclear power. I think there's the possibility that the fourth generation nuclear power could actually solve some of our problems, because it could burn nuclear waste and would not require any mining of uranium for the next 1,000 years. So we have to have an open mind and allow the competing possibilities for energy to prove themselves. And I think we should be open-minded about nuclear power.
We're seeing a change. There are fewer and fewer skeptics, but they're out there. There are skeptics, including a prominent meteorologist former founder of the Weather Channel. What's your argument to the skeptics who say that things are still inconclusive?
Well, it's become very clear. Those who have looked at the history of the Earth, the paleoclimate data, and have looked at what's happening now in the Arctic and on alpine glaciers all around the planet, the empirical evidence has become very strong. And, you know, I really think the next president should ask our National Academy of Sciences to make a quick but thorough report on what the status of understanding is, because these few contrarians get much more publicity than they deserve. If the scientific community, the National Academy of Sciences, could put an end to that or clarify the situation quite easily, and I think that would be very helpful if they would do that.
Dr. James Hansen from NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies with Minnesota Public Radio's Tom Cran. A giant storm with straight-line winds, also known as a derecho, tore through northern Minnesota on July 4, 1999. Winds of over 130 miles an hour flattened millions of trees in Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The Mammoth Storm is one of the longest live derecho events in recent memory. The same storm raced eastward across Lake Superior a few hours later. Marlon Bree was sailing on the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee on his boat Persistence when the winds hit. Amazingly, he lived to tell about his story. The book is called Wake of the Green Storm, A Survivor's Tale. Marlon told Kathy Werzer, Craig Edwards, and Dr. Mark Seeley what happened when the storm hit.
I was just across the Canadian border heading for what I thought was a shelter at the mouth of Thunder Bay called Thompson Island. And I looked over my shoulder at this crown, what I thought was fog, following me in the Sawtooth Mountains. And suddenly, there it was, some big monster that simply jumped over the Sawtooth, and then I was in it.
I hear that it was determined that this was a progressive derecho. That's pretty rare, I understand.
I understand it is. I did a lot of work with the Storm Prediction Center out of Norman, Oklahoma, after I got back because I was greatly puzzled about what had happened to me, especially since the papers and the media here in the Twin Cities were reporting 80-mile-an-hour winds, and I just did not believe all of the reports that I was getting, because the damage up there that I saw on the ground after I finally got to shelter was horrific, with centuries-old trees actually torn up by the roots and laying on their sides.
Marlon, of course, we all know wind speed is affected greatly by the roughness of the surface or
yes.
the surrounding terrain.
Yes.
And, of course, there's a lot of friction induced by the forest as well as the rolling landscape up in that area of Lake Superior. It's not out of the question that winds aloft and unobstructed winds across Lake Superior could have been much, much higher than what was reported by the National Weather Service.
That's what I understand. The guy I was talking with that's setting up the NOAA website said, Elmer Johns said that, no, Robert Johns said that wind speed over Lake Superior may have increased 5 to 10%.
Mm.
So that would have been a... I wish I had a speedometer. As it is, all I had was a small 20-foot sailboat that was in the grip of this thing, and we were having quite a time of it.
Well, let's talk about that here briefly. When did you know you were in big trouble?
Right after the heavy winds started to hit. I have a little unofficial wind speed gauge on my boat called the Shrouds, and I've heard various wind speeds in the 20, 30 years or so that I've been sailing on Lake Superior. And here the wind in the rigging started to shriek and then howl and then go off the scale in something that I hadn't heard before. And something like a giant hand sort of gripped the top of the mast and started levering the entire boat down into the water. And at that point, the boat bucked, stopped, and did a semi-pitch pole, and I flew forward into the cabin down below. And there were some more shrieks, and I saw water coming up through the centerboard trunk, and I saw my starboard port light turn an interesting shade of green, and that's when I realized that the side of the boat was underwater.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Craig Edwards, I know there were warnings out there for this storm, but obviously a sailor like Marlin, it seemed to be caught off guard.
Well, I'm trying to get a handle on this whole thing because from what I was looking at with regard to the history of this storm, that it looked like there was quite a bit of wind already reported in portions of north central Minnesota. And as the storm was racing through the boundary water canoe area there, that they had warnings out, they were concerned about it, saw it well on radar, and it looked to me like from mid-morning on to about early afternoon, there was enough indications, particularly on a holiday, that people should have been cautious as far as going out sailing, because this storm actually looked like it was starting from even early morning hours, racing across portions of northern Minnesota. And I was wondering what you knew before you set out on the waters, or what time of the day were you on the waters and had an awareness for the weather and the overall circumstances?
Oh, sure. First thing I do on Superior is turn on my NOAA weather on VHF, and I was getting the weather forecast that said 4th of July would be the hottest day of the year with fair winds, but a thunderstorm possibility late afternoon. And since I was starting out of that old fur fort, Grand Portage, and heading up toward the Canadian border, I thought I'd easily make it. The only indication I had was that the weather was indeed fluky. There was heavy fog on the lake as I started out, ducking in and out of fog banks. And as I progressed, the weather brightened, and indeed I thought this was going to be a wonderful day on Superior. And I actually had my destination in sight, which is Thompson Island, when all of this happened. As I understand it, it was simply a thunderstorm that started out on the border of Minnesota, had 60-mile-an-hour winds. This kicked up to 80-mile-an-hour winds sometime in the Boundary Waters canoe area, when it combined to be a perfect storm, that rare progressive derecho that roared across the Boundary Waters, downed millions of trees, and went out the Atlantic coast and back. There was no warning where I was, other than a brief klaxon sound from Thunder Bay Coast Guard on their weather, because I was now in Canadian waters, and it said heavy weather warning. And then I heard the report that a sailboat had overturned and boaters were in the water. And then it was on me, but the derecho was never announced. And I understand from the Storm Prediction Center that the nature of the derecho is such as that it cannot be predicted in advance. And I've been to various websites, including the Natural History Museum, which shows that radar, that bow-shaped echo forming, but it does so briefly, and then the Duluth Weather Service loses that echo. So we had sometime during that morning the story of a warning that high winds were coming eastward, although that did not reach me through NOAA weather. Some of the people that were in the Boundary Waters and in Grand Marais. I just returned from Grand Marais last weekend, talking with some of those people, and they said there was some warning that a windstorm was coming, but no mention has ever been made of a derecho during the time of its formation or its actual toppling of millions of trees in the boundary waters, which is an unfortunate thing because this is an exceedingly dangerous storm and one which is of particular danger to campers and boaters during July.
Absolutely. You know, both Mark and Craig as experts here, is it difficult to predict a derecho?
Well, I think since the 99 storm, the SPC, the Storm Prediction Center, has developed better methods for forecasting these, and in fact, they often present the situation in their forecast discussion. So I think there's been some improvement in that regard, although their development can be rather rapid, and therefore the warning time can be rather short on these types of storms. Fortunately, these types of storms are far less frequent than simple severe thunderstorms or tornadoes or things like that. But
interesting.
Yeah.
And Craig, how would you describe to the uninitiated how this would form in a storm, the derecho?
Well, what you have is you have boundaries that set up, and then you have a strong jet max over the top of you with winds of maybe 80 to 90 miles an hour at 20 to 30,000 feet, and these thunderstorms ascend above that level. They capture these winds and they drag them down to the surface, and so you have an acceleration of the movement of these storms. But Kathy, I know Bill Togstad at the National Weather Service in Chanhassen did a study on the May 30th and 31st storm of 1998, and that storm was very long-lived with 130-mile-an-hour winds that went through just south of the Twin Cities and on into Wisconsin, all the way over to Milwaukee. So once they form and you see it on radar with the radar coverage, there should be 20 to 30-minute warning on these storms, even though they're moving maybe at 40 to 50 miles an hour. The dilemma the Weather Service has is when you say a severe thunderstorm, that usually means maybe some dime-sized hail and 60-mile-an-hour winds. So you almost have to ratchet this up a notch by saying this is a very dangerous storm. And in the Weather Service, we used to have a term called very severe thunderstorm, but that was a little bit confusing, so we just call them severe thunderstorm warnings now. And I think the issue that has to be made with these types of storms is there needs to be more urgency and more emergency-type information shared saying we have a very dangerous storm, even more dangerous sometimes than a tornado warning. Because if you have a wind of 120, 130 miles an hour, and you'll have an F0 tornado, that's only 75-mile-an-hour winds. So you can have stronger winds during a derecho than you have during a lot of the tornadoes in Minnesota.
I got to ask Marlon here. When last we left your story, your light on the you were underwater pretty much in terms of part of your boat, Marlon. How in the world did you escape dying, really?
Well, for a while I was very concerned that I was going under and would have to start swimming up to the top of my keel, and it was my hope then that I would sit atop the boat and be blown probably out into the middle of Superior, at which time I would start worrying about getting back. But finally, what happened was that after the initial gusts went through, and I just don't know how much microburst energy there was, but it was substantially in excess of 100 miles an hour, I guess. The winds went ratcheted down somewhat to maybe 60 or 80 miles an hour, and I had hurt myself going into the cabin because I was simply thrown in there because the boat bow dug in under speed, and I was thrown forward, much like a bully on a teeter-totter tosses the lesser occupant. I picked myself out, went out to the cabin, went out to the cockpit, and just in time to see three heavy fenders, rubber fenders, that I had laid out for my arrival in Thompson Cove go one by one up into the sky for some reason. And finally, what happened was that as the boat bucked around, the engine was out of the water, the rudder was out of the water, and as it went over, I simply tossed myself over the side enough to put my weight on the side of the boat, since this is an ultra-lightweight centerboard 20-foot boat, I had some effect. When the wind finally went down, the boat simply plopped back down in the water. The mast came back up, and the spetters at times were touching the water. And I could head off successfully, and I simply turned it around, turned the outboard up to full throttle, and headed for the nearest pile of rocks that I could find, at which point I simply rode out much of the storm behind the rocks, keeping my speed up, and I was in the cockpit. Incidentally, it's a couple of things about this wind. It's a downward wind that's pressing on you. It is very violent during the open phase, and it's also very cold. Now, for that 4th of July day on Superior, I was wearing long johns, winter fleece, and a boater's jacket with fleece on the inside, and I was in some state of hyperthermia. I was shivering so badly.
Wow.
My goodness. What did that wind burst do to wave heights on the lake? Did they go up substantially?
No, actually, everyone asked me that, and they said, we must be in terrible waves and all of that sort of thing. And actually, the downburst came and it smashed the water flat. And when I first emerged from the cockpit there after the pitch pull, I looked out, and there were simply long furrows of spume thousands of feet long and maybe 20 to 30 feet in diameter, writhing like snakes on the water all around me.
Marlin, your tale is amazing. Goodness sakes.
It was very interesting. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you joining us and telling us a little bit about what happened to you way back there in 1999. And it's interesting to note what these duratios can do. I mean, just the power of them. It's pretty amazing.
It was a learning experience for me, certainly. I learned about duratios for the first time, and I'm so glad that to hear from the learned guests that we are getting some better weather reporting going, and that people are now starting to get informed about duratios. And thank you for your broadcast.
That was Marlin Bree. He was sailing on Lake Superior at the time of the duratio event of July 4th, 1999. And he's the author of Wake of the Green Storm, A Survivor's Tale. See more about Marlin's tale on the NOAA.gov website under Duratios and at his own site, marlinbree.com. We want to let you know about a very special live jet streaming event at the Minnesota State Fair, Thursday, August 28th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Please join us at the Minnesota Public Radio Building on the corner of Judson and Nelson, and be a part of the live audience as we discuss Minnesota weather, climate, and what climate change means for Minnesota. That's a wrap for another week of Jet Streaming. For Kathy, Mark, Craig, thanks for joining us. Our producers are P. Ray Rudolph and Jim Bickle, and our studio engineer is Rick Scooter Hebzinski. See you at the fair next week, and remember to keep your ear here to Jet Streaming and keep your weather eye on the sky.
Hot town, summer in the city. Shadow in the city, all around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk hotter than a match head. But at night it's a different world, go out and find a girl, come on and dance all night, despite the heat it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city.